Thank you, Jacques, for that very friendly introduction. I think it was Adlai Stevenson who, once being given a very enthusiastic introduction, said, "After hearing that, I can't wait to hear what I've got to say." So thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the Vice-Chancellor for telling me so much about the history of academic freedom in this university, and also bringing me up to date with the threats that obviously are very real still. I thank the university for the invitation to give the T.B. Davey Memorial Lecture. It is, of course, a great honour to be asked to commemorate the independent stand that the university took during and after T.B. Davey's vice-chancellorship against the law imposing academic racial segregation. I feel a bit diffident because the topic I'm talking about today, which is indeed the threats posed by the commercial marketing approach applied to education, are so obviously much less dramatic than the threats that T.B. Davey faced, and they don't call for heroism in the, at all, really, or certainly not in the scale that T.B. Davey had to show, and T.B. Davey and his generation in the university. But I hope to try to convince you that the more subtle threats, which I'm going to focus on today, should be taken seriously. They're just as real, and they, in the long run, can very seriously, I believe, endanger the academic freedom on which universities depend. I'm going to follow T.B. Davey in I'm partly going to follow him in taking the list that the Vice-Chancellor gave about which were all to do with teaching, who should teach, who should be taught, choices only to be made on academic grounds. I want to add to that research. T.B. Davey may well have had research in mind as something that fed into teaching, but I want to emphasize research as well as an independent thing. Now, the fundamental question I want to start with is, why does academic freedom to decide matters of teaching and research on purely academic grounds, why does that matter? Why should these institutions, universities, be privileged in this way? And the answer I want to give is by spelling out what I take to be the core functions of a university and arguing that diminishing academic freedom frustrates or impedes a university in carrying out the core functions it has. And I believe those functions are valuable, and I'm going to spell them out a bit. I'm going to divide them into two. There are educational aims, what a university hopes to give its students, and then there are wider aims of a contribution to society through research and other things that a university does, independent of teaching. Now, of course, these aren't quite separate, because one contribution a university may hope to make to society is by the good it does to its students in the hope that they in turn will enrich society. So I'm dividing them in this way, but there's a degree of artificiality in separating out the educational and the social function. But let me first turn to the educational function of a university. I want to suggest really that there are two central educational functions, and again, they're not entirely separate, but I think they're worth taking independently. One is intellectual development of students, and the other is personal development. Obviously, intellectual development is central to a university. It would be bizarre to have a university that took no interest in the intellectual developments of its students. In 1852, John Henry Newman, in his book The Idea of a University, argued that knowledge is a good thing in itself, independent of whatever valuable practical applications it may have. Now, when he said knowledge is good in itself, he didn't mean just the accumulation of any old random facts. He talked about the kind of knowledge that enlarges a student's mind. And so he argued that things that open up students to new experiences, new thoughts, may even be disorienting. These are of great value and importance. And the second thing he said about knowledge was that a university should aim, you can never achieve this aim, but it should at least aim for universal knowledge. In order to create a community in which students, mixing with other people doing other subjects, while they never become masters of those other subjects, are aware of the bigger picture. We don't want narrow economists, narrow philosophers, narrow physicists. We want people who have at least some conception of where their subject, where the questions they ask, fit in with other subjects and with the questions of broader interest to the human race at large. And I believe that that picture of knowledge sometimes pursued for its own sake, independent of any utilitarian purpose, and to try to, as it were, at least sketch out a picture of human knowledge in the round, not just in some narrow field of it, I think that's still central as the intellectual function of university teaching. But I mentioned that there's also personal development, which isn't quite separate. These intellectual things that a university does can have a very striking impact on individuals' personal development when they come. I want to mention a thing which Bertrand Russell talks about in his autobiography. When he went to Cambridge University, he afterwards described an experience. What he wrote was this: "The one habit of thought of real value that I acquired there was intellectual honesty. This virtue certainly existed not only among my friends, but among my teachers. Once, during a lecture on hydrostatics, one of the young men interrupted to say, 'Have you not forgotten the centrifugal forces on the lid?' The lecturer gasped and then said, 'I've been doing this example that way for 20 years, but you are right.'" And Russell, later, when he was at Trinity College as an undergraduate and as a teacher, later, sadly, Trinity College during the First World War, with respect to Bertrand Russell, betrayed one of the ideals of academic freedom. Bertrand Russell was in prison for his activities of protesting against the war. And Trinity chose to, the Council of Trinity took away his lecturership. And Bertrand Russell, writing in his autobiography, said that it had been a blow to him that even at Cambridge, intellectual honesty had its limitations. But that until then, because of the intellectual honesty, he said, Cambridge was the only place on earth that I could regard as home. I want to mention one other. You'll notice, by the way, I teach philosophy, and so you'll notice that I'm being parochial in this lecture in two rather importantly limiting ways. One is I teach philosophy, so some of my examples come from philosophy or philosophers. And the other is that I'm British. We British are notorious for our insularity. And a lot of the university crises I'm going to talk about are actually, I'm going to take British examples. But my hope is that the examples I take may actually resonate a bit with you, and that in the discussion afterwards I'll hear what I need to change in view of your experience in South Africa. But the other example I want to give, it is a philosophical example again, I'm afraid, of somebody, the impact of someone on someone by her teachers in philosophy. The psychotherapist Margaret Cohen wrote an autobiographical book about her career, and she described the effect on her of philosophy teaching at its best. She says, "Quite by luck, I went to University College London to read philosophy in the early 1960s. Here I was taught by Stuart Hampshire, Richard Volheim, and Bernard Williams, later by Hide Ishiguro, Miles Byrne-Yates, and Jerry Cohen. Such different people, but all with something in common, their love of ideas. I was astonished at the intellectual freedom that seemed to abound here. No longer an assumption that there were some things you must necessarily think, things that were absolutely right or wrong. Our luck was to be taught by people who seemed to take any and every idea seriously, to follow it through and see where it went. Now, of course, that's her intellectual development, but I think it did have a profound personal impact. I don't think you can fall in love with academic and intellectual freedom without it being a personal matter too. And indeed, a lot of the teaching that goes on in universities, I mean, I very much doubt whether becoming really interested in neuroscience has absolutely no impact on the way you see yourself or other people. And I think that to read Tolstoy or Shakespeare is to make them part of yourself in a really important way. In fact, I doubt if it would be worth having them as academic subjects if they didn't have this kind of personal and emotional impact on somebody's development. Now, I'm in danger of sounding like a TV commercial for academic education. I should let slip the thought that I am aware that not all teaching is as brilliant as what Margaret Cohen found. I am aware that we're all us academics are capable of being boring or narrow or not living up to Newman's ideals in other ways. But nonetheless, I think this is an ideal that people strive for, and it's an ideal worth preserving. Now, I want to talk a bit about the impact of the market approach to education, the impact it has on the educational aims of the university, of intellectual and personal development. For Newman, the enlargement of the mind, sometimes coming from intellectual upheaval, was of value in itself. And some of us think that, related to that, what Russell learnt about intellectual honesty or Margaret Cohen learnt about intellectual freedom are of value in themselves. But of course, Newman and those of us who think like that are open to a challenge from practically minded people. What claim have these values? You happen to like people falling in love with academic, with intellectual freedom, but what claim does that give them for public funding? Why should these particular preferences of yours, these things you happen to like, count? Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, once said, other things being equal, pushpin is as good as poetry. Quantity of pleasure being the same, pushpin is as good as poetry. I'm never quite sure what pushpin was, but I imagine it's the equivalent of those kind of arcade machines that people play. Why should they be, isn't it elitist, as people say, or paternalist, to push for those values when other people may prefer the arcade machines or a university that simply devotes itself to teaching people how to make money? Now, the market view of value, I think, comes from, you know, in a way, very respectable origins. The idea that we should perhaps be skeptical about the idea that there are values out there written in heaven, which we somehow discover in the way astronomers may discover a new galaxy somewhere. And so the market view of value starts, I think, with the thought that things only have value because people want them. And then the next bit is that people, the only way to measure how people want things is how much they will pay. So the market then comes in as a kind of adjudicator of what things are worth having. And so on this view, the one main thing, perhaps the main thing, a university does for students is giving them the skills needed for productive work. To encourage people to choose higher education, claims are made that a university degree increases lifetime income. This tends to downgrade intellectual or personal development as such. Results, class of degree matters, indicates relevant skills, employers aren't interested in anything else, and so on. Now, to some of us, this is the triumph of means over ends. The phrase comes to mind, knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. But in the same way, the intellectual contribution of universities to society is taken to be mainly economic. And this, in turn, influences what governments think should be taught, and sometimes what governments are prepared to fund. Here I take the recent British debate. In 2003, Charles Clarke, the Secretary of State for Education, said that the state should only pay for university subjects of clear usefulness. He explained this. What I describe as the medieval concept of a community of scholars seeking the truth is not itself a justification for the state to put money into that. We might do it at, say, the level of a hundredth of what we do now, have one university of medieval seekers after truth as an adornment to our society. There was a degree of outrage expressed in Britain about this, and a spokesman for the Department of Education and Skills, it keeps changing its name. There's a story in that, Education and Skills. But the spokesman tried to defuse the outrage that many of us felt at the remarks of Mr. Clark, and I'm not sure that he succeeded in making the minister's comment more palatable. He said the Secretary of State was basically getting at the fact that universities exist to enable the British economy and society to deal with the challenges posed by increasingly rapid process of global change. Now, firstly, there's something odd about this being a fact. It seems to me not a fact at all, but his opinion. But it also seems to me a rather dismal opinion. And one of the reasons why I spelt out, in a way that may have seemed platitudinous to you here, the wider aims of personal and social development and so on, intellectual development, was partly to have something to contrast with this kind of narrow view. I should say that in the conclusion of this debate, under a different government, in 2010, 100% of British state funding for the teaching of the arts, humanities and social sciences was removed. Now I want to turn to the core social functions of a university, just briefly to mention them. Obviously, I mean, I don't want to deny, of course I'm glad that universities train people to get jobs, but it's very important for people to get jobs, goes without saying. I'm also glad that the university makes economic, medical, technological contributions to society, which really are of absolutely direct benefit. But what I want to talk about is some of the wider contributions, because in a market-oriented society, it's pretty uncontroversial that the medical, technological, industrial benefits are real. I want to say, let's not overlook the others. And what are the other contributions that a university hopes to make to society? One is increasing, preserving, and transmitting knowledge, not necessarily just immediately applied knowledge. Universities aren't the only institutions that do research, for instance. Many corporations carry out huge research programs, but universities with the focus on the public good can often carry out research programs that defense contractors or pharmaceutical companies say would not find worth their while to do. It's not only creating new knowledge, it's also preserving and transmitting knowledge to future generations. Universities support museums, libraries, and so on. But most important of all, by what they pass on in their teaching, they transmit knowledge of an immediate practical kind, an immediate set of intellectual skills, which mean that future generations don't just inherit museums, but actually inherit living cultural and intellectual traditions passed on from generation to generation. They also help to raise the level of public awareness and discussion. They also help to sustain free inquiry, independent of censorship, and the value of objectivity in trying to understand things. Universities also stand for certain values and the public good. Medical education isn't just scientific, it also includes things like medical ethics and law. Universities shouldn't discriminate on the basis of ethnicity, gender, religious belief, or sexual orientation. They shouldn't invest their capital in companies that use sweated labor, in tobacco companies or the arms trade. University research should not be on weapons or methods of torture. Now, I know there are borderline cases here, and we can discuss exactly what the boundaries are, but I hope that some of you, at least, I hope many of you, will share the idea that universities also stand, as well as for their educational function, for some idea of the public good, some idea that there are things that in deciding what research a university carries out, the public good should be an important part of it. Now, turning to research, the impact of the market model. I'm going to talk particularly about the managerialism and the competition for public funding, which tends to be part of the market model. One of the peculiar things, and I'm again drawing heavily on the British experience, but I think it may not be so different elsewhere. One of the peculiar features of the British experience is that actually much of what universities produce in the way of research isn't hugely marketable. Of course, it's true that academics write books on Shakespeare. It's true that academic science sometimes does have huge spin-offs, but quite a lot of it doesn't. And so if you want to use the market as a means for deciding what research should be done, you have to create a kind of artificial synthesis of something rather like the market. And the way that that's been done in Britain is that the government has imposed competition between universities, between faculties in universities and so on, for funds on the basis of how they score in terms of ratings given on a system of, I forget how many it is, four or five something stars and below. This is something which used to be called, when it started, it was called the research assessment exercise. It's now changed to the research excellence framework. And I think there's as I hear the word research excellence, I think I see the influence not of academic values at all, but of the world of public relations and political spin. If one thinks of some of the great intellectual contributions made in British universities over the last 100 years or so, I can't hear in my imagination the phrase research excellence coming to the lips of Maynard Keynes, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Francis Crick or Stephen Hawking. It just doesn't seem the sort of phrase that real academics would actually use. One of the weird features of this also is that when you're asked what is it we should be trying for in our department, you're told excellence, quality, and the criteria for that are left pretty fairly unspecified. And as a result, there become strong distorting pressures on individual academics as departments become frantic, desperate to win the competition so they don't lose funding, but having no clue about what the criteria are, they flail around. And sometimes it's not too subtly indicated that someone retaining a job may depend upon their producing something which looks four or five star or whatever it is. And one result of this is that the rapidly published journal with something which is called high impact factor, with something that has high impact factor, easily trumps the major book of slow gestation that may take many years to do. In fact, I mentioned Wittgenstein and Crick. Their publication record during their early career was about as close to zero as you can get. And it's very unlikely that they, for instance, would have survived in the current pseudo-market regime. I want to now turn to questions about corporate funding and research. A couple of months or so ago, Oxford University was given just under £6 million for a new Shell geoscience laboratory and for research into natural energy resources. It was claimed that this would help meet future energy needs and also help mitigate the impact of climate change. The university was criticised for accepting the gift in a letter signed by a number of distinguished alumni. They wrote, "Shell's core business activities and political lobbying are pushing us towards a future with a global temperature increase well in excess of 2 degrees centigrade. Oxford's own climate scientists are warning us that we need to leave the majority of known fossil fuels in the ground. And yet this new partnership will undertake research that will help Shell find and extract even more hydrocarbons. Now, I don't know enough about the facts of what the likely good and bad impact of the Shell research is likely to be. But it seems to me clearly worrying when universities being largely deprived, largely starved of public funding, have to turn to corporations. Can we really believe that the corporations won't partly use it to whitewash their activities, as some people say Shell is doing about some of its activities in Nigeria and allegedly its fracking here? And can one really believe that Shell won't push for research which is more of commercial value to Shell than really for the public good? And the climate change issue, I think, certainly raises this question. I also want to mention the impact on individual scientists, and here this fits in very much with the Vice-Chancellor's remarks about the survey done in Australia. I want to focus on a particular case, the case of Dr. Nancy Olivieri. I flag up to open, free, whatever you call it, full disclosure. I know and admire Dr. Olivieri. After the scandal I'm just about to describe, she came to do our course, our MA course in medical ethics and law at King's College, and she made fantastic, she's an extraordinarily impressive person, and I felt that I, teaching medical ethics, with her coming back from fighting a great battle on behalf of medical ethics, I felt like an armchair strategist being confronted, to my own embarrassment, with a frontline soldier just back from the heat of battle. And she taught me, of course, much more than I taught her. But I flag this up just to say, you know, you could look out for a bias. She's somebody I know, respect, and like. However, I think the facts pretty well speak for themselves. Nancy Olivieri worked at the University of Toronto and at the Hospital for Sick Children. She and a colleague had a grant from the company Apotex to test their thalassemia drug, deferiprone, in a trial against the standard drug. To get the grant, they had to sign a confidentiality agreement. The research found that in a substantial number of patients, the drug gave no improvements or even made their condition worse. Dr. Olivieri thought it was her duty to warn her patients and the public that it might be ineffective or even harmful. She raised this at her institutional review board and at a scientific meeting. She sent the results for publication. Apotex brought a $20 million legal action for her violation of the confidentiality agreement. And I just, the mind boggles at being a, you know, moderately paid academic and being sued for $20 million. This seems to me bullying of the first order. The University of Toronto was at the time negotiating a large donation from Apotex. The hospital's medical advisory committee referred Dr. Olivieri to the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario for research misconduct. The hospital and the university publicized the referral widely. Again, that publicity must have been enormously damaging to Dr. Olivieri. When the thing was finally investigated, Dr. Olivieri was completely cleared of all the accusations. But before justice was finally done, a hospital had failed to stand up for a doctor who carried out her ethical duty to warn of possible harm to patients. And a university with a financial interest at stake had failed to defend the academic freedom of one of their scientists. Instead, both had joined in trying to bully and intimidate Dr. Olivieri. Now, have I got 5 minutes left? Thank you. I wanted to, I'm worried about running a bit late, but I want to just briefly say something about the market model, about state control, and the possible middle course between these two. The rise of the market model isn't at all surprising, given the amazing catastrophe of Eastern European and Soviet socialism. The total collapse of that, it being an economic failure as well as an oppressive and, in Stalin's time, hugely murderous system, the same kind of thing being repeated during Mao's time in China, it's not surprising that people reacted against an economy and a society hugely under state control. And it's, as a result, it's if the if having everything run by the market is the obvious alternative, then it looks to me pretty much like the clear winner. But it isn't the only alternative. Society is more complicated than that. But I want to go back to an old paper which Maynard Keynes wrote in 1926, a lecture he gave in Berlin that year, called The End of Laissez-Faire. And he argued for two things, which I think, if people had actually read the paper and thought about it, much of the evils of the 20th century might have been avoided. Because so much of the 20th century was the whole Cold War period, when we nearly blew ourselves up over should the things be run by the state or by the market. If people had listened to Keynes, people might not have had such crude views. Keynes argued that we need to distinguish what's technically better provided by the market from what's technically better provided by the state. In other words, an empirical matter. And, we might find, for instance, I'm inclined to believe that health care is something the state should provide, whereas handing over the technological developments in computers to some state-run bureaucracy would probably be a total disaster. In other words, I may be wrong about either of those things, but we should look and ask, what is the function of this particular organization, and in what setup will it flourish, in the market or in the state? But he also argued not only that we have to choose on grounds of results what works, what doesn't work, but he also argued for there being a third thing, autonomous bodies within the state, which were neither under state control nor under the total influence of the market. What he said was, I suggest that progress lies in the growth and recognition of semi-autonomous bodies within the state, bodies whose criterion of action within their own field is solely the public good as they understand it, and from whose deliberations motives of private advantage are excluded. Bodies which in the ordinary course of affairs are mainly autonomous within their prescribed limitations, but are subject in the last resort to the sovereignty of the democracy expressed through Parliament. Keynes's first example of such a body was a university, but others today might include the legal system, professional bodies, research councils, public broadcasting corporations, and others. Now, I think the Keynes vision of these semi-autonomous things, not market, but not under the thumb of the government, corresponds very closely to what Eastern European dissidents protesting against the Soviet system talked of when they said they wanted civil society. They wanted education to be seen not as just producing good communists. They wanted scientists having freedom to publish research, not having to put little footnotes about Marx, Engels and Lenin at the bottom and so on. They had the idea of a more general idea of the public good. Now, of course, we defending our universities in relatively free societies, should not exaggerate the comparison with communist society. I remember going to Poland in the communist period, and the secret police were visible, and everybody had their letters open before they were. I must say, I have some worries about the emails these days in our society. We shouldn't exaggerate. We don't have to be heroes to stand up for the independence of universities and academic freedom in the way that, say, T.B. Davy had to in the past, or in the way people in the Soviet system had to. But nonetheless, some people, Nancy Olivieri, for instance, have had to show considerable courage in standing up to market forces. But although we shouldn't exaggerate the similarities with dissidents in Eastern Europe, the vision they had of a society with a plurality of institutions guided by the public good, interpreted in terms of a plurality of values, is relevant to us. The threat to this vision and to the academic freedom bound up with it is less brutal and more subtle. But the vision, I think, is still worth articulating and defending. Thank you.